Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a movie of the week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it's shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Tasha Robinson, and because the situation this week is so serious, I have banded together with my greatest allies and enemies,
Keith Phipps,
Scott Tobias,
and Genevieve Kosky.
On the first half of this episode, we discussed Brian Singer's 2003 film X2, which has mutant heroes and villains joining forces against a genocidal technological plot that would murder all mutants. In this episode, we're looking at Avengers Infinity War, in which heroes joined forces against a genocidal, essentially magical plot that would murder literally half the inhabitants of the universe. It's hard to remember in 2018 that there was a time before the Marvel Cinematic Universe, before the era in which Disney-produced, Marvel Studios-planned movies were laid out in an ambitious schedule unfolding years into the future. It's also hard to remember that less than 20 years ago, Hollywood really hadn't meaningfully cracked the superhero movie code, and that superhero comics on screen reliably produced some pretty awful movies. But starting with 2008's Iron Man, Marvel's team launched a winning formula, equal parts smart aleck banter and high stakes, with a lot of thrilling on-screen action and protagonists with strong individual goals and personalities. The individuality became increasingly important as these movies piled up and as they started to cross over. If Tony Stark and Bruce Banner and Thor and Black Widow all essentially looked alike on screen, as so many previous comic book heroes and villains before them had, it wouldn't have been remotely meaningful when they all met up and started to clash with each other. The fan response to Avengers Infinity War and the immense, intimidating piles of money even the worst-received MCU movies have made over the past decade certainly suggests that viewers have identified their favorite characters, have taken a rooting interest in their fights and their behavior, and authentically care what happens when they meet each other. But there certainly is a question of how long Marvel can maintain this run. The studio has been consciously developing towards this specific moment for a long time now, and in the process, they've been mirroring some of the biggest strengths and worst problems that Marvel Comics has also faced over the years. On the upside, memorable characters with problems that make them seem human. Fans who love them and identify not just with the characters, but with the actors playing them. A form of brand loyalty and devotion that's completely redefined the cinematic landscape, skewing it toward long-term franchise plans and big crossover events. On the downside, increasingly baroque and complicated storylines, individual films that make no sense unless you've seen everything in the series, and a formula that can seem pretty repetitive once you see the strings. So what to make of Avengers Infinity War, the film that pulls all its predecessors together and then seems to wrap up half the Marvel Cinematic Universe's storylines in one big bang? We will straight up warn you that there are spoilers for Infinity War ahead as we try to make sense of it all. Excelsior.
In time, you will know what it's like to lose. Dread it, run from it. The end is near.
We got one advantage. We have what Thanos wants. So that's what we'll use.
I think it's good, except it sucks, so let me do the plan, and that way it might be really good. Wow.
Today we don't fight for one life. We fight for all of them.
Groot, put that thing away. Now, I don't want to tell you again. Groot.
I am Groot.
Whoa, language!
Oh, Scott Tobias, what do you think of Infinity War?
I really didn't like this film at all. Am I going to break from the whole group? I don't know Genevieve's opinion yet, but it was a clarifying experience for me in the sense that I remembered as I was watching it that what I like about the Marvel films, generally speaking, are the beats between the action sequences when you have time to kind of get to know these characters, and you know, there's a lot of loose talk and that sort of business. The action itself, much of the time, fallen short for me. So having a 150-minute film that's all one gigantic action sequence with no other beats to it.
That's unfair. There are several gigantic action sequences smushed together.
Several. That's true.
And they sometimes take upwards of 60 seconds for characters to interact with each other in meaningful ways.
That's true. I mean, where is the first act? Does there have to be a first act? I mean, what this movie is misbehaving for me on that in that
the
respect.
The first
too.
Act is 2008's Iron Man.
That's exactly right. I mean, that's not what a movie does. You can't just immediately plunge us into action for 2.5 hours. I was absolutely wrung out. I mean,
you're saying is just follow the cookie cutter, save the cat, Sid Field formula, and then everything would be a lot better, right?
I think
it's a radical break. I can't.
Oh, that's right. You're trying to say that this is an avant-garde film. Yeah. Okay, I got it.
Just structurally speaking.
You know what? It pushes it. I mean, to me, it's like, it felt like watching a Michael Bay film, except without the pretty images. So it was kind of like that.
Scott Tobias.
For me.
Scott Willstrom Tobias. Who are you?
I don't know. I mean, I enjoyed some of the characters that were funny that kind of got together. I don't know. This one, it killed me. It's maybe the worst of the Marvel films for me. It's certainly towards the very, very bottom. It was just the opposite of what I have liked about these films in the past.
Woof.
Yeah. But you all enjoyed it.
Somebody
though.
Who is not Scott?
No, I dug it. I don't really disagree with anything you're saying, though, Scott. I mean, mm-hmm. I've been thinking about why that is since I saw your tweets and like, you know, and my own enjoyment of the film is curious to me because it is a lot of what you're describing. Mm-hmm. But I think at this point, maybe it's that I do read comics, you know, and I'm kind of used to like reading a stack of comics that give you a little sliver of a story that's that everyone looks different from the other. It's kind of all tied together. But I think in some way, I think the Marvel movies have trained viewers to think like comics readers, where, you know, there's always these big crossover events and they're never great. But they're always kind of fascinating to see all these characters interact in like one big story that you're really reading more to find out what happens than any other reason and how it's going to change the universe forever. And I think that's kind of what we're all doing with the Avengers films. I think we know they're not going to be the ceiling is much lower than for the individual character films. Like Black Panther was great. I really loved Spider-Man Homecoming. And this was really entertaining, I thought. But it's really entertaining in part because I'm invested in this whole project and these characters, and there's a shorthand developed, and it's like it's kind of fun to see Doctor Strange mixing it up with Spider-Man. That itself is its own pleasure. Yeah, and Tasha, you've tipped your hand already. You like this movie.
I ate up this movie like a big bowl of gelato. I really enjoyed the experience. And more than once I have come on this podcast and said, yeah, this movie was doing a lot of things that in the abstract I love, and yet it just didn't work for me, to the point where somebody on Facebook actually called out how little he was looking forward to a film he liked getting the Tasha Robinson that treatment. This film is doing a bunch of stuff that in theory I shouldn't like. You're right. It's a long action scene interrupted by essentially fan payoff. Hey, here's what would happen if character Z and character X finally got together over tea.
Is it interrupted? It felt relentless to me. But.
Oh, man. Yeah. But I enjoyed it so much. And every single one of those, how are these two characters going to get along to each other? Like every single one of those moments I enjoyed. Mm-hmm. When I realized the film, it's also another thing that it's doing that I very often hate in movies is it's such a video game quest movie. You know, here are a number of items that we've got to collect one by one. And along the way, like some people are going to die. There are going to be a bunch of mini boss fights and then the big boss fight and then a series of big boss fights in this case. I should not like this movie. I'm really invested in these characters at this point. I find the vast majority of them very charming. I find a lot of kind of Marvel's extratextual stuff with these characters, with the actors, very charming. There's an appeal to them, but mostly I'm invested in the same sort of way that the first Secret Wars crossover, like the first crossover you experience in comics is just this big, exciting, how is this all going to interact? How is it going to work? Is exciting. And then everyone after that is like, they're just trying to make you buy comics that you wouldn't normally buy. Like, I don't.
Secret Wars 2.
Secret Wars 2 is a really good example of that. I don't think I'm going to come back to this movie over and over again. And I don't think that I would have the emotional attachment if they did it again more than once ever. But as it was, my experience in the theater was like sitting there like a spoonie with my jaw hanging open, just like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen next? Genevieve?
Yeah, I'm pretty positive on this movie. Sorry, Scott.
That's fine.
But I think it's interesting that we keep kind of talking about like how it does function as like a big comics crossover, and like the three of us who did respond to it all have more experience with superhero comics than you do, and I think maybe are primed for the structure of this film in a way that maybe you are not, and have a certain purism about how film is supposed to work. And like, this doesn't work like how any other films work. Like the Marvel movies are the only movies that can work like this on this scale. As far as your question of like where the first act ends, or, you know, like where
exists.
Act one ends.
Yeah.
Or does it exist? Like, it does, but it's not act one. It's issue one. Like, this is essentially like a 6-issue arc, you know? And like, we start in New York with, well, I guess there's like the prologue on the Asgardian ship. But like, the first issue is like the next attack on New York, you know, and the big donut. And then we shoot off into space. And then we have the next issue, which is Thor and the Guardians meeting up. And then I forget where we go from there, but
yeah. I mean, Hulk crashing through Doctor Strange's window is really the sort of the, it is what you're saying, it's the end of issue one moment, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, what's going to happen next month?
Yeah, exactly. And one of the things I did really like about this movie that sort of connects to this idea is just how we hop around this universe, and like we go to so many different places and planets, and they each kind of have their own little story, like Peter Dinklage on the dwarf planet, which is such a bizarre little like detour in this movie that like the more I think about it, the more I like kind of have affection for it just because it is so weird. But so yes, like I totally understand like the feeling that it is just like one big action sequence, but it's not. It's just a bunch of issues of a comic that have their own big action sequence, sometimes maybe two per, and then it all culminates in this big event at the end. That is not even the final event of this event, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, we are kind of at the midpoint of whatever is happening with this story.
Which,
I
mean, despite an amazing amount of marketing for this film, I cannot count the number of people that have asked me, so this is the end of the MCU, right? Like, after this, they're stopping making movies. Like, in all seriousness, there are a ton of people out there that didn't realize this was part one of a two-part story. And it reminds me, as I am so often reminded, that we kind of like live in a little bubble of film people that know a lot about what's coming up and like sort of what the movements are and what the language is of sort of the cinematic world. There are a lot of people out there to whom like this is not an event. This is a movie that a lot of people are talking about. And so they might go see it. And I really wonder what that experience is like, just sort of walking in. Everybody's watching this film. Maybe I will too.
Yeah. Oh, I know.
I've seen I can't imagine MCU movies. Sure, why not?
I can't imagine being that person in this situation and not being utterly confounded by it. But I was thinking, I mean, it's a cliche at this point to say, but I'll say it because I believe it. I mean, that these movies do, on a whole, the way they're designed, the way that they're kind of templated, they do function more like television than film, I think. And this is the type of like mega episode or a series of episodes or end of a season or end of a series or something in which you get a whole lot of payoff for a bunch of things that you've spent a lot of time setting up with the previous films. But that's not necessarily the way film works. And so to encounter a film like this, you know, even for me in the context of having seen all of the Marvel films, it's jarring. And I think one's reaction to it, broadly speaking, might have to do with whether you're just simply invested in the MCU and these films are not. And my level of investment is just not. As much as I think the films, by and large, have been pretty good, it's just not as strong as other people. And I think it really cost me in this case.
I mean, you talk about this isn't what films do or this isn't how films work, but it is now. I mean, not only have they
done
it.
Well, it's how these films work.
Well, that's just it. So many other people are trying to duplicate this experience. And I feel like I have enjoyed the vast majority of the Marvel movies. I did not enjoy the first two Thor movies. And there have been hiccups along the way. But for the most part, I've enjoyed this series a lot. I have not enjoyed the way it's warped the cinematic landscape around it as people look at the amount of money it's making and think, all we really need to do here is throw out a series of stories and we'll make that kind of money.
I wonder if that's going to keep going, though, because only other franchise that's been able to emulate that is Star Wars, mm-hmm. which was already, you know, that was probably going to do okay anyway. But I think the whole idea of doing sort of these expanded, the Rogue One, Solo, Star Wars story is inspired by, you know, putting a movie out every year that's part of a bigger universe. But everything else has fallen apart. I mean, the DCEU is really on shaky ground. I think we'll have DC movies for a while, but this whole idea of like doing it like Marvel, I think it's kind of falling apart.
I think the Universal Monster films are
they're looking great.
Well, I mean, there was a certain point where there was going to be, they announced like this extended Robin Hood cinematic universe. It wasn't even just like another Robin Hood film. It's going to be a 5-film series, and I think King Arthur was going to be that as well. And it's just not working out. I had to admire the architecture as much as anything else. They figured out what they were doing and they did it right.
There's also just this feeling that any property people can get a hold of, like maybe we can spin it into both a TV show and a movie series. Mm-hmm. And it's like, we don't have the fundamentals of the first film down. I'm thinking of The Dark Tower here. But at the same time, like they launched that with like, this is going to be like 8 films and an ongoing TV show. Well, okay, maybe get the script down for the first movie before you launch into all of that.
Well, that's the other thing. You give them a lot of credit for architecture, but also they've really done a good job with these characters. There's a reason these movies work is that people connect with these characters. And this movie does not work at all if you're not invested, or apparently even if you are. I mean, I know you like some of the Marvel films. Mm-hmm. But.
I mean, thank God for Thor Ragnarok, because like Thor is such a big part of this. Like, I mean, probably second only to Tony Stark and arguably a bigger component of the narrative than Iron Man is. But like, if Thor Ragnarok, I love Thor Ragnarok, and if it hadn't been as good as it was and given me the affection for that character that I have now, I don't know if this movie would have worked the way it does. And it's interesting because it was in production before Thor Ragnarok came out. So I think I read some items about like Chris Hemsworth being a little instrumental and sort of urging them to like give Thor a little more comedic juice, you know, here to sort of reflect the character he became in Thor Ragnarok as opposed to the first two Thor movies. But yeah, this is all my way of saying that I absolutely loved Thor in this movie. And he was like, you know, the part of it that I connected to the most.
I feel like we kind of defined him a lot better in the Avengers movies mm-hmm. than in the Thor movies. And I feel like those movies felt like a little bit more of a test balloon. Especially the first one, because in the second one, he kind of disappears and has adventures that got cut from the theatrical release. And that was a big mess. But I think one of the things that makes these films work so well is the way the characters play in the interaction with each other. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got so much ego and attitude and arrogance coming off of Tony Stark. Like in his films, he has to have something to kind of like push back against him. And those things are almost always like dour and relentless. And like they have a tendency to tamp him down. But he comes up against other heroes in the MCU and he has to get like bigger and brighter and louder in comparison. Mm-hmm. People write a lot about the villain problems in MCU movies. And I think that that's very accurate. But at the same time, the void that is the villains kind of has given the heroes a lot more room to take up a lot of space in these movies and be interesting.
That said, Thanos does get the closest thing to a full arc in this movie. I am not the first person to say this. This has been observed many times, but like Thanos is sort of the main character of this movie, you know, and it's the Thanos origin story in a lot of ways. And the heroes are just sort of around to define Thanos and to an extent.
Yeah, and as a payoff for some really lackluster Thanos lead-ups, mm-hmm. I thought this was a pretty surprising movie. And that actually may also have something to do with my enjoyment of it, Scott, is that it surprised me in quite a few ways because the Marvel formula is so much about once again, angry alien gets glowy hoobajoob and wants to blow things up. And I was expecting that again here, and I was expecting to be pretty bored with it, as I've been bored with Thanos up until now.
But this time you need 6 hoobajoobs. Well, plus the big hoobajoob to put them all in.
He smushes them all into one big hoobajoob in the end.
So how is like, okay, I'm going to talk like an idiot here. Okay, there's a time stone, correct? This yellow stone.
Mm-hmm. How Don't ask me which color the time
is. It yellow?
Is. I am not that big of a dork.
Okay. I think it's green.
Green?
It's the one.
Well, is it okay? But in any case, how is that different from the whole circling the Earth thing in terms of the narrative effect?
I think we'll find out in the next film when they have to undo wiping out half the universe.
Exactly. But then, how does that end have any resonance if we know
So here's where we get into some like theorizing. But so Doctor Strange was the guardian of the Time Stone, and we have that little moment when they're on Titan and he's like, you know, using magic to go over all 14 million possible scenarios for how this ends, and there's only one where it, you know, the outcome is good, you know, where they win basically. And after that is when Doctor Strange essentially like gives up the Time Stone to Thanos, and he has like that one line to Tony, like, we're in the end game now. So sort of like the theory is that Doctor Strange has foreseen how this all plays out, and this is just sort of a stopover on to the final resolution, the one good resolution.
Yeah, he says something like, "I had no choice," which you can read.
He says it was the only way.
Which you can read as, you know, I was compelled to do this and had no choice, or this is how we win.
So that's where the Time Stone, I guess, probably comes back into play, because Doctor Strange knew he had.
But I think Scott's larger point, though, is that it's trickery.
Yeah, I mean, it's all magic. It's all.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's Doctor Strange thing. It'd be a lot easier for me to accept, I guess, if it does work out the way it's been theorized.
Well, I mean, keep in mind that if nothing else, assuming that the Time Stone is the answer, and I would not assume that because Thanos has come up a lot in the comics and he's been defeated by a lot of different heroes in a lot of different ways.
Captain Marvel on the horizon.
We still have Captain Marvel on the horizon, who Kevin Feige has told us is the most powerful Marvel superhero ever to appear in the movies in a walk. So there's a lot going on in the future that is as yet unknown. That's as maybe. If it's just somebody picks up the Time Stone and uses it to rewind time and everybody's fine, there's still the question of how to get there, because first of all, it looked like that the Infinity Gauntlet was fried by killing half the universe. And second of all, Thanos still has it. And all of the heroes couldn't beat him, so how are half of the heroes going to beat him?
Yeah.
There's, and also, there's still a how. How is it going to happen?
Right. And a lot of people died before that moment in the movie, too. So, you know, how far back do we rewind? Like Tasha said, it's the how.
Were none of you bothered, I guess, by the fact, to my mind anyway, that the film didn't have another gear? I mean, that it was constantly going, that you didn't have a pause for breath or another feel.
I mean, I think that final moment after Thanos snaps his finger is the next gear, and it's just, it's not a bigger, louder gear, but it's a completely different thing.
But it's, but you don't, it takes so long to get there in the film. I just found it like, it just shut me down after a while. It happens with me with Michael Bay films as well. And occasionally with these films, it's like you get pounded with so much visual information that isn't, I don't think, all that well articulated. I don't think the Russo brothers are particularly good at staging action.
I think they're good in Captain America Winter Soldier. I think the action scenes are much cleaner in that. And it's been kind of a step down with every
But this needs to be that. I mean, you talked about, I think Tasha mentioned on Twitter about how this whole movie was like the airport free-for-all in Civil War, but as a whole movie. And the thing is, like, that sequence I really enjoyed because it was such a standout sequence. It wasn't part, I wasn't seeing a bunch of those sequences all strung together. It was all a lot of build up to this moment that was hugely satisfying, and I just didn't feel like this film offered that. It was a very difficult film for me to just grasp aesthetically, you know. And I think it may be just a generational thing. It may just be a lack of interest on my part, but there's just the way the film functions. It's just, it's like filmmaking as like a second language for me. Like, I don't get it. I don't get the way this thing is put together. It's leaving me behind because I can't imagine enjoying this film, and you all enjoyed it. So I don't know. I'm flummoxed by it, and I feel it's tough to feel alienated from the biggest thing going in movies right now, but that's kind of where I'm at This film really underlined that in a big way.
I guess I don't feel like you're giving the movie credit for the pauses that it does have. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, this movie was full of downtime moments. You know, the moment where Thor interacts with the Guardians of the Galaxy and it turns into a big one-upsmanship contest.
Yeah, I enjoy those.
The moment with Thanos and Gamora, like on the planet where they meet the Red Skull again and debate what love is over his decision to kill her. I mean, the whole business on the giant donut ship where Spider-Man and Doctor Strange and Tony Stark are trying to figure each other out. Yeah, that really old film Aliens. All of the business between Scarlet Witch and Vision. I mean, to me, this movie is full of downtime moments where we get to see characters who have never met interact with each other, and we find out a little more about their personalities. It didn't seem relentless to me.
Not all of it works, though. The Scarlet Witch Vision stuff is pretty drippy, I thought.
Oh my gosh. I absolutely agree with you that there's and the whole the business that I just cited between Thanos and Gamora, like I fully believe that he does love her in his way. It's very hard to me to accept as emotionally resonant a form of love that includes and I'm gonna murder you for power.
I got some laughs out of the film, though. I mean, the film has a nice,
surprisingly funny.
It's got a lot of good, you know, offhand wit. And
I should have stayed on the bus.
Yeah, and some of the it's, again, seeing some of these characters who hadn't spent.
There's a spaceship. We're all gonna die.
I mean, I really liked. I liked having the Guardians of the Galaxy people finally kind of mingle with others that we'd seen.
Yeah, and like before. I liked the realization that even though we are aware of these characters all in the same universe, they aren't. Mm-hmm. Like I did feel like kind of a little thrill in the Guardians, like finding out that the Avengers are even a thing. You know, there's a certain satisfaction in seeing all these pieces come together for the characters, not just for us. Mm-hmm. But I want to really quickly go back to your comments about the action, because like, well, I agree this isn't like the best action in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I disagree that it's all the same type of action sequence, because I think especially in some of the earlier ones, I'm thinking specifically of the donut ship in New York, the Russos make a point to like separate everyone into groups of two. Like there's lots of one-on-one battles throughout this film. Not just in that sequence, but there's lots of like smaller pairings of two or three. Also, when they come for Vision and Scarlet Witch, everyone gets kind of like paired off into one-on-one, two-on-one type of scenarios. You get like more like a bunch of skirmishes. It's not all giant, all-in battle scenes. You get the one giant all-in battle scene in Wakanda.
Sure.
But everything leading up to that, I think, is at a slightly lower pitch, just in terms of who's participating, if nothing else.
Scott likes the movie now.
that's a fair point. That's a fair point for sure.
I feel like so much of this movie is, again, predicated on whether you care about the characters. Mm-hmm. And I've talked about that in terms of caring, a big thing for comics fans, superhero comics fans, that I've never gotten is what would happen if these two characters fought each other? And I have never cared about that. What would happen if these two characters talked to each other is another thing. Mm-hmm. But leaving that all aside, I think one of the things this film does that I really enjoyed is it finds a sense of threat for all of these characters, and it uses it to find out what they care about. And I found that over and over again, I found it emotionally evocative. And the fact that the film uses so much of that for humor makes it so distinctive from a lot of the X-Men movies and all of the DCU movies, except a little bit Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
So the fact that these people are people who can joke in the face of chaos and death and the end of their universe, I find it really charming.
Yeah, I mean, it aims to please for sure, and it does so. Pays off the characters. I mean, there are some nice moments, sort of spackled throughout the film. So we give it credit for that. I'm actually curious though to get your impression on the ending, since people have been yelling at each other about that for a while.
I was spoiled on the ending going into it, just kind of by nature of having to figure out coverage for Vox. I had to kind of know what we were getting into with the ending before I was able to see it myself. So I went into it like knowing specifically which characters got erased. I knew everything down to a beat, more or less. It still very much worked for me. Like, I obviously didn't have the shock, although I did have the delight of hearing other people in my theater react to it, which was great. but I still found it affecting, I think, on a purely spectacle level. Just the way that moment is executed with the sound dropping out, and I think the visual of them dissolving is very effective. And I even like teared up a little at Spider-Man. Like,
yeah, that's the one.
Spider-Man
that's
death,
it,
I think, was the definitely the most affecting. Mm-hmm. So even though I know that these deaths aren't going to stick, I know that there are sequels planned for Black Panther and Spider-Man, you know, I still could appreciate it in the moment for the effect it had as the culmination of the story that is being told in this film specifically.
It's well staged too, in that you get the fake out about Tony Stark dying and then he doesn't die. And then they sort of eliminate some characters you can see. Yeah, maybe they can get rid of them. It's like when we get to like Black Panther and Guardians of the Galaxy, what is going on here? You know, it is sort of this escalating dread, although I was spoiled on it going into it too. But you're right. I mean, Holland's moment is really affecting. I mean, even though you know what? Sorry, Scott, but it's movie magic here because you know this isn't going to stick. But then in the moment, at the same time, it's like they killed Spider-Man, you know? This is really sad.
He doesn't want to go. He doesn't want to go, Mr. Stark.
From what I've read, he improvised that line. That wasn't in the script.
Yeah.
And it's one of the film's biggest cuts.
No, it's really good. Is this the only Marvel film with like a consequential like end credits sequence scene, right? I mean, like that.
I mean, arguably, Iron Man in 2008 had an incredibly consequential credit scene when it introduced the Avengers initiative.
Oh, sure. Okay. You know. Okay. I guess we have to concede that. But I thought like, hey, you know, I'm kind of glad I stuck around. This is probably good to know this information.
Do you know that is Captain Marvel's insignia, though? You had to look it up.
I learned.
There are a few places you can go on the internet to find
like a
out
beeper,
more
right?
about
like,
the
it connects
MCU
via
films.
Beeper?
Well, the film's in the 90s, so that would actually make sense.
That's how the time stone's going to come into play.
Oh, my God. I found the ending, like, for me, it was a slightly empty experience because of that feeling. They're comic book deaths. None of them mean anything. And there was a moment where I thought they were going to leave it to people we maybe really didn't want to see go, but that the MCU could actually let go of. And then people started disappearing that I was like, nope. None of this is going to stick, not in a meaningful way. So I don't know. For me, listening to other people in the theater respond was very emotional, and watching the other characters respond was very emotional. Mm. I mean, I really like General Okoye as a character, and seeing her like put her life on the line over and over and over for Black Panther, and then just watching him puff out in a
it's interesting because we watch her in that moment. We don't actually see Black Panther, like we see like his arm dissolve, I think, but we don't actually like have the moment of him, you know, evaporating. We watch her. That's a really good point that I think a lot of the effectiveness of that moment is in like how stunned all of the remaining characters are and how just at a loss and empty they are in that moment.
While we're here, can we just briefly nerd out who's actually going to be dead? Because of the like the pre-finger snap deaths, I don't think Gamora's gone.
No. I think Loki's definitely gone.
I don't think so at all. Hiddleston has been.
I thought Loki was like the sure
I think
thing,
Loki will
sure,
come back
sure
maybe in a couple movies.
There's I don't think he's necessarily back in Avengers 4, but I mean, assuming Tom Hiddleston is game and or can be lured by dump trucks full of money, he is such a fan favorite character. It would be a tremendous waste. And he's a god, and he's an illusionist. There are so many ways to fake out on that thing. Like, there are so many ways to take it all back. I think Loki's coming back.
I think Heimdall's gone because Idris Elba is too big a star for that smaller part.
That's probably true.
I don't know about Vision. I don't know. You know.
I feel like they're going to bring him back.
I mean, he's a robot. He can be rebuilt.
What about Hawkeye?
Hawkeye's not in this one.
Hawkeye's on an island.
What about Ant-Man?
Not in this one.
He was in every battle. He was just too small to see. And we never went micro.
Apparently the events of Ant-Man and the Wasp like happened concurrently with whatever is happening here.
Interesting. I am intrigued by that.
Yeah. I knew you would be, Scott. That's why I brought it up.
I saw a pretty good tweet that was effectively like Ant-Man and the Wasp. Scene 1, they both dissolve. End credits. So yeah, there's so much more we could talk about. We've really barely even scratched the surface of, hey, did we like this movie? And we could probably talk for 20 hours about individual characters while Scott slowly taps his fingers on the table. But instead,
I just like to hear you all talk about it. I don't really have a lot to add.
But instead, we should probably take a break and then come back to talk about the connections between X2 and Infinity War.
Tell me his name again.
Thanos. He's a plague, Tony. He invades planets. He takes what he wants. He wipes out half the population. He sent Loki. The attack on New York. That's him.
This is him. What's our timeline?
No telling. He has the power in space stones. That already makes him the strongest creature in the whole universe. If he gets his hands on all six stones, Tony...
He could destroy life on a scale hitherto undreamt of.
Did you seriously just say hitherto undreamt of?
Are you seriously leaning on the cauldron of the cosmos?
No, no.
All right, well, now it's time for connections, when we bring these two films together and talk about all the things they have in common. I think one of the big things here to talk about with both of these films is how they handle, like, the individual moment versus the big plot arc. Like, both of these films have a lot to balance in terms of trying to give most of the characters some sort of meaningful reason to be on screen and trying to service, like, the great big plot arc. And we've talked about some of that, but I'm wondering if, especially if you've got any particular call-outs with either film in terms of maybe a non-main story arc that you think was actually, like, particularly well or badly done.
I think I want to talk about, especially because we briefly touched on the lameness or emptiness of the love story in X2 in the first half. I want to talk about Peter Quill and Gamora in Infinity War and the whole thing with her making him promise to kill her, and more importantly, the moment where Peter Quill basically ruins everything because he's mad at Thanos for killing Gamora, and, like, how just dumb a moment is for that character. I think Infinity War is, like, a bad movie for Peter Quill in a lot of ways, in terms of just...
That was a low moment.
It was a low moment for him, and like, the just, like, I feel like he's kind of caught on the back foot for a lot of this movie, just in terms of pitting him against Thor and, like, nobody listening to him, and then having to, like, kill his girlfriend and not even being able to do that because Thanos has a reality stone, and just, like, all this stuff. I think, like, the storyline between him and Gamora is actually, like, one of the more like, fleshed out ones in the film. But it just, like, does, I think, really weird things for the Peter Quill character.
It's the only romance in the MCU that's really come close to working. I mean, they might get there with Peter Parker in a future Spider-Man movie, but it's the only investment I have. And certainly we kind of touched on it before, but Scarlet Witch and Vision, all that kind of happening between movies didn't really help that storyline.
Also transitioning directly out of him basically keeping her under house arrest because he had decided it was for her own good,
yeah,
and her fighting back against it. And we transitioned directly from there into we're lovers.
Is it? Yeah. I mean, Wonder Woman kind of gets a little bit of romance in there, but it's a romance starved genre.
There have been a lot of interesting pieces written about how the MCU is a pretty sexless universe. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, there's sort of a, Tony Stark is a playboy and has bedded lots of women but wants this one woman. Thor is a playboy and has bedded a lot of women but wants this one woman. Like, over and over the pattern.
I like Tony and Pepper together a little bit. That's kind of works for me.
I like her perpetually kind of rolling her eyes at him, like, this isn't what I want. The problem is, of course, she turns into what I've always called a John Grisham whiny wife, where her only role in the story is, yeah, to say, stop all this heroism, stop being so exciting, like, come home and be boring. And that's kind of an uncomfortable tension.
Is this kind of an overreact in a way, though? I mean, there are plenty of opportunities that I guess Marvel seem to be turned down over and over again for love interests and things like that to develop, simply because they usually don't work and you want the characters to be freed from all that business. But then you end up in the situation where you have all of them together and maybe you do want a little bit of that and you don't get it.
Well, I think the big problem is so many of these films are based in comics that were sort of conceived at aiming at teenage boys. And the idea there is that romance is pretty icky. Hmm. So over and over and over, you see these relationships that only exist in order to cause angst when they're torn apart, or when they're, when one of them has to give up, when Peter Parker has to give up Mary Jane and have his past completely rewritten by Mysterio, or when somebody gets fridged, essentially. So many of the relationships only exist to cause pain. And here we see it happen with Vision and Scarlet Witch. We see it happen with Peter Quill and Gamora. And there's no sense that either of those relationships ever meant anything before the moment where we're told, oh, they're going to be broken apart. Much as in X-Men, we kind of get the feeling that we only really care about the relationship between Jean and Scott, who are both pretty boring characters who we don't see have happy times. We only care about them because Wolverine might become between them, or because he's angsty about the fact that he can't.
He's the bad boy. What's the line? Like,
God,
like
that line about girls flirt with the bad boy, but they want to go home to the nice guy.
Yeah.
Super gross.
Yeah.
This is an X-Men 2?
Yes.
Yes.
All that stuff was all gold. All
Linda Holmes, I think on Pop Culture Happy Hour, made a really interesting point that the problem with Peter Quill and Gamora is that the movies did not care about Gamora as a character until they needed her to destroy, basically. And I thought that was a really interesting idea, that she's always gotten underserved as an individual character. She's always just sort of been there for the romance. And now suddenly they need depth out of her and they haven't done the homework.
I think that's fair. I think the only reason that's not entirely true is that Zoe Saldana is such a strong presence in as Gamora, is such instantly winning and like good at reacting without saying anything. Like, oh, if you're not gonna give me a lot of dialogue, well, I'll let you know what I'm feeling anyway. You know, she's quite good.
I mean, I'm not a fan of Guardians 2. I did not like it very much at all, but I do think that film did a little work in terms of fleshing out Gamora and Nebula kind of in tandem as like or fleshing out their relationship, which I think became important in Infinity War. So like, I think that Gamora has gotten a little development outside of her relationship with Peter, but you know, obviously it's taken to a different realm in this movie that, you know, maybe it didn't entirely satisfactorily set up. But I don't know. I think there's definitely stuff in Guardians 2 that sort of lead to what we get with Gamora here.
I do enjoy, I mean, the films have done a long, slow build with Tony Stark and his like growing sense of responsibility and his growing sense of stress over possibly failing that responsibility. I like that this film did not lean too heavily on it or spell it out, but by the end of it, we basically got him standing in the middle of his worst nightmare. Mm-hmm. And because they did the groundwork on it, we know what that feels like without anybody having to explain it to us.
I mean, I guess the equivalence to that in X2 and the X-Men series in general is Wolverine / Logan, who just maybe by virtue of being in the movies more than anyone else, like, has the most sort of developed persona and developed arc and sort of the most things that his character is concerned about, and they tend to dovetail with the bigger villain action, such as with Stryker in X2 and sort of the ongoing question of Logan's past and where he came from and so on, which by this point in the X-Men movies is very, very well trod, but in X2 is still like sort of a mystery that is unfolding. And even though I think Professor Xavier is like by far the most powerful mutant in this scenario, like Logan / Wolverine is the most important mutant to the story just by virtue of having the most questions about what his story is that the film can explore.
You know, I enjoy the payoff of that arc where he, as I said earlier, decides that his found family is more important than endlessly exploring the past. But I feel like how the movie gets him there is in some ways really weak. And the moment where Magneto's like, oh, sure, Stryker, like, doesn't everybody know about your past but you? Because the professor has decided you're not ready for it. There's a weird streak of paternalism in all of that that's just like, you're not ready, so I'm going to let you literally traverse around the world trying to figure this out without telling you, when I could just say, hey, you're an experiment. This guy did it. He's bad. Like, how hard would that be? Come on.
That's a good point.
Well, we should perhaps move on. One other thing that I wanted to bring up that may leave Scott standing out in the cold.
Nope, I'll just listen.
Is just how much both of these films draw from their respective comics. All of these like tiny little pieces, again, like Nightcrawler being religious, or, you know, the entirety of Peter Parker's arc. I feel like so much of what we get in both of these movies is meant directly to speak to fans, and that you can see the evolution from X2 to the MCU in general of just everything we give the fans, they will notice. So as long as we can make it unobtrusive enough to not be too distracting to more mainstream audiences, like, let's just keep feeding them M&Ms.
I mean, I think X2's ending with the shadowy figure rising below the water, you know, like, that's something that I imagine would mean nothing to people who aren't familiar with the comics and what happens with Jean Grey and Phoenix. I don't think I knew. I mean, I've actually never read a whole lot of X-Men comics, but I just like knew about Dark Phoenix, like just sort of by being around comics people, I guess. But I can't imagine how that moment played to someone who, and Jean Grey's death for that matter, how it played to someone who didn't have that knowledge. But and
maybe you're really excited about that third X-Men movie.
Right.
Really?
Yeah. It didn't work out though, did it?
Even if it had worked out, but really? I was never invested in the Phoenix saga. Like, were you actually super excited?
Oh, for sure.
It?
I mean, I was looking forward to it for sure. I would like to see that storyline played out. But I felt it was a good setup for it.
Had that really been done yet at that point, the sort of marking like this is where the next sequel in this franchise is going to go? Like, just such a clear road sign pointing forward.
Yeah, Batman Begins ends with the discovery of the Joker card, if I'm not mistaken. But yeah, well, that was later though, so perhaps you're right.
I mean, if you go back to like Star Wars, for instance,
yes,
like it's pretty clear where things are going after Empire.
Well, but that's not basing it off of like prior knowledge from a different medium the way the way X2 is.
Oh, I see what you're thinking.
I can't really think of another example. No,
I can't either, but I bet there's someone who's listening to this right now that has a brilliant
going
example.
Nuts, just going nuts. Just I gotta send their email now.
I think that those people should look for comments at nextpictureshow.net and perhaps send us an email. What about the mass extinction plot? Like, once again, guy with a hoobajoob wants to destroy mass amounts of people. Like, is this a plot that still works at this point?
You know, it's been done before. Obviously, we're talking about X2, but it seems kind of novel in Infinity War, because it's like, oh, this is someone with some reasoning behind what they're doing. It's not just domination. There's too many people, too many problems, you know?
Not much love to go around.
Yeah.
The universe is really vast, though, right?
There are a lot of resources.
I'm not saying, yeah. I don't think it's a good plan.
Yeah. I do like the idea that it is, you know, random. I think in terms of like a mass extinction plot, that is sort of an interesting wrinkle, and that it's not really targeted the way that it is in X2, first at mutants and then at humans.
Or, you know, just genocide generally is very directed.
Exactly. Yeah. There's usually some sort of ethos behind who is being targeted, and like there's an ethos here too, but like the randomness is part of it. So it's interesting. It's, you know, it's a bad plan, Thanos, but I see what you were going for.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it helps that they present him as just kind of incontrovertibly insane. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't really bother spending much time on justifying it.
He's the mad Titan. He's mad.
Which, you know, in Age of Ultron, that did not work at all. There were just sort of endless, okay, I see step one, and then you're on step three, which is kill everybody. What's step two exactly? Where do the underpants gnomes come into this?
Because the internet is bad. That's what.
The internet is bad, so kill everybody.
Yep.
I mean,
I see that sentiment on Twitter every day, so.
Who's more relatable, Ultron or Thanos?
Who's more relatable, Ultron or the internet? Twitter. Maybe we should just kill off half of Twitter, just randomly.
I would prefer a more directed approach to killing off Twitter.
Yeah, but you know, to be fair, you've just got to... I do think that it's really interesting that, you know, so many of these comic book movies, I'm thinking of X-Men Apocalypse right now, are like, let's kill all the weak. You know, let's kill like everybody but people who are exactly like me. And it becomes a very obvious metaphor. And here it's just like, I don't care. Let's just kill 50% of everybody straight up. I think it does make it more interesting. Yeah.
The question I have is Thanos himself part of the like, did he also have a 50-50 chance of extinction?
I don't think so, yeah. Either.
Because that would be really, really radical if that were the
case.
He's
protected by the Infinity Stones somehow.
Which stone protects him?
Save all six of them.
Well, I think all of them combined probably have a pretty good...
Sorry, the answer was the reality stone.
Can you name all six stones?
I think it was the plot stone.
Does everyone know all six stones but me?
Absolutely, as long as you have no follow-up questions whatsoever.
Well, they're all different colors, right? They're very pretty stones.
Gosh, is this the nerding out over in incredibly small details about comics podcast? Or is this the "this is not what film does and I am angry" podcast?
Go ahead, Tasha. What do you have to say?
I have to say that this is not what film does and I'm angry podcast, because I'm so much more interested in that.
Okay. I don't know. I'm glad that people enjoy the film. If I'm trying to just understand this, the phenomenon, there is maybe something to be said for a film that is able to take a lot of shortcuts because so many things have happened before. And there's so much off-screen action and things that have happened in all of the movies leading up to it that can pay off, and you don't have to be situated within the narrative. You know, I think that's like television as well. I mean, you know, our friend Noel Murray, one of his precepts is like, you should be able to watch, you know, turn on any TV show at any time during its run and be able to watch it and appreciate it, et cetera, as this distinct unit of television. I always felt like that in the age of serialized storytelling I never really connected quite as much to it as Noel, though I defer to Noel's wisdom on television. But this is functioning like that as well, in that it isn't holding your hand in any way. It isn't really behaving like most films behave, and it's because you can take all of these shortcuts and treat it more like the climax to a very complicated world-building serialized series.
Well, I think that's actually a good place to wrap it up. In fact, two of us are going to now evaporate, and the other two of us, I don't know which two.
How random is it?
It's super random.
You should stay because you're hosting. I mean,
everybody's got the script sitting in front of them, so it'll be fine. Well, two of us will be fine. We'll see how this goes. On the other hand, we're in Genevieve's apartment. There are other people in this house. Maybe we'll all make it. In the meantime, X2 is available on Blu-ray, DVD, and on various streaming services. And you can expect Infinity War to be in theaters until probably somewhere around Christmas, the way it's currently going. At least until Ant-Man and the Wasp and or Captain Marvel come out. We'll be right back with your next picture show. Finally, it's time to catch each other up on films or film-related items we've seen in the interim since our last podcast. We call it Your Next Picture Show in the hopes that it'll put some interesting choices on your radar. Genevieve, what in the film world has been good to you lately?
So earlier this year, the film-centric corners of the internet briefly came down with a severe case of Paddington fever, with everyone seeming to lose their collective mind over Paddington 2 and, by extension, Paddington. It's 2015 for Bear.
Oh, yes.
I did that for you, Scott.
That was great. I love it.
There were two bears maximum.
So at the time, I had seen Paddington and liked it well enough, but I was sadly unable to convince anyone to go see Paddington 2 with me in the theater, so I kind of missed out on the first round of Paddington Mania. But now, Paddington 2 is officially available for digital rental, so I was recently able to check it out for myself, and I'm here to report that the reports of Paddington 2's greatness have not been exaggerated. The sequel takes all the things that made the first film feel so refreshing among children's films and dials them up a few more notches. The unfailingly polite Paddington Bear, voiced by Ben Whishaw, is still good-natured and curious in equal measure, leading to some big, lively, comedic set pieces. The film's storybook-centric production and animation design are both more adventurous and still quite lovely, particularly in some sequences that emulate the look of a diorama or pop-up book. And the role of the cartoonishly posh but evil villain has been filled by Hugh Grant, who has a legitimate claim to one of the year's best performances with this movie, I'd say. There's also a supporting turn from Brendan Gleeson that's quite wonderful, I'd say. And again, like the first Paddington, this film uses Paddington's status as an immigrant to weave in some lightly metaphorical ideas about the value of multicultural communities and the dangers of prejudice. But it keeps it all couched in this friendly little clockwork narrative that keeps it from ever feeling too heavy-handed or moralizing. Like its namesake character, this film is quietly and unobtrusively extraordinary and all but impossible to describe without using the word delightful. So I won't even try. It really is quite delightful. If you've seen it, you probably don't need my recommendation to see it again. But if you haven't seen Paddington 2, it's available for digital rental and purchase now. and I recommend it.
Oh yeah.
Second. So who's the Paddington naysayer at this table? I'm looking over at Tasha.
Me. I'm only a naysayer in that I was sold it on this is the greatest film of all time. Like David Ehrlich was literally just like it's gonna sweep all the Oscars.
Wow.
Like big over the top hyperbole, which is obviously tongue in cheek. I got some of that from you too though, Scott.
No, I think it's legitimately great.
But there's a difference between legitimately great and it's gonna win all of the awards.
No, that's
so I understood that I was getting hyperbole, mm-hmm. but you know, I went to see it and I found it like I deliberately skipped the first one because I was like, children's picture book adapted to full length movie, CGI version of a character running around. It's going to be dreadful. And on your recommendation, I rented it, watched it, and then went straight to the theater and watched Paddington 2. So back to back double feature.
Okay.
I thought they were charming. I thought they were surprising. I was not over the moon for them, basically.
Not even Hugh Grant. Wasn't Hugh Grant the difference maker in this thing?
Hugh Grant was pretty delightful. Yeah. That moment when he's up in his attic talking to his costumes it's really quite winning.
Yeah. I mean, you really
Exit get Bear to... pursued by an actor.
It's so good. And you get to see him just go places as an actor you've never seen Hugh Grant.
I like that he doesn't even work that much anymore. So it's kind of, he just works when he wants to. And to make a total fool of himself in Paddington 2 is one of the things that motivated him to get off the couch. I appreciate that about him.
Well, and I just liked how playful Paddington 2 is with a lot of its visuals. Like it almost feels like Wes Andersonian in a lot of parts, but not quite as airless as Anderson can be sometimes. But yeah, and there's lots of little animation sidebars that are neat. And I feel like the movie is just sort of having a lot of fun with itself without being especially like self-conscious or performative about it.
For me, I think it was just like the first one, the family is uncomfortable with him. They don't necessarily want him there. And there's like this sort of tension of like, will this bear find a home? Will he find happiness? Like, is there a place for him in the world? And in the second one, like they're all on board. They're all kind of, they've gone from being very distinctive characters, Infinity War style, to all kind of being the same character. And it's really pretty much just Paddington and Hugh Grant. And I felt it lost a little something with that.
Oh, see, I like the Browns better in the second one, but we don't need to go too deep into Paddington 2. Although I said this when Paddington 2 came out, like it's too bad that we already did Babe because as a pairing on the podcast, because like Babe feels like a corollary to the Paddington movies.
Sure.
And actually, I guess Babe, we could have done
Babe,
it with Pig in the City.
That would have been great, yeah.
That actually may have been a even better pairing, mm-hmm. but alas.
Alas.
Make it a double feature for yourself. Scott, what's your recommendation?
I wanted to recommend a film for you Stanley Kubrick fans out there called Film Worker. I just did a piece for Rolling Stone on the movie. It's documented by Tony Zierra, and it's about this fellow named Leon Vitali, who started as an actor. He was an actor in Barry Lyndon. He had just like a line or a very small part, but Kubrick responded to him so much that he just kept expanding the role, etc. And then later on, he became Kubrick's right-hand man and was with him through every production after that. And his role evolved. I mean, he became, you know, he was a casting director, he was a dialogue coach, he was a Foley guy, he did color timing, he did promotional art, you know, he worked really closely with Arlie Ermey and with Danny Lloyd, and considers himself still the caretaker of Kubrick's work, you know, after he died, you know. So Matthew Modine compared him to Igor and to Kubrick's Dr. Frankenstein. I think that's a pretty good comparison. I mean, somebody who's completely devoted to Kubrick in a way that's self-effacing and mysterious in a way. I mean, he acquired all of this skill and he worked himself almost to death. I mean, very, you know, he'd worked, you know, 14, 16 hour days carrying out whatever thing that Kubrick wanted him to do. I mean, and it could get small. It could be like making sure the Turkish subtitles are right or making sure the promotional art in some faraway territory is reflective of what he wants. I mean, it's that detail oriented. So, you know, as a documentary, it could be more Kubrickian, or it could be more pleasing stylistically. It's a pretty straightforward, almost like a video supplement you would see on a disc. But it's still, he's an absolutely fascinating guy, Leo Vitali. I got to talk to him for like 50 minutes on the phone about all things Kubrick, and it was just a really great conversation. And I think, broadly speaking, Filmworker is about enforcing an appreciation for below the line people, you know, the unsung hero types. And he is certainly an accomplished below the line guy who deserves his time in the spotlight. So Filmworker.
Where can people see it?
Well, people can see it. It's going to be at the Metrograph in New York starting May 11th. And then it's in Los Angeles on May 18th. And is rolling out from there. If you live in Chicago, it's going to be here at Music Box at June 1st, which I assume will probably time up with the 2001.
Yeah, they're doing the 2001 unrestored 70mm, some other Kubrick
which he was involved in, by the way. Leo Vitali was involved in that, in the 4K transfer. And I asked him about what his future plans are, and he's like, well, there's always other Kubrick films that are going to be transferred to 4K and transferred to Blu-ray, and he's going to be involved in making sure that it looks as close to the way these films should look as Kubrick would have wanted. So it's pretty remarkable. Filmworker. Tasha.
Well, I'm going to super cheat here because I'm coming off of back-to-back film festivals, and like my film watching for the last several weeks has mostly been things that people are not going to be able to see for a while. So I'm going to call up one of those. I actually just rewatched it at the Chicago Critics Film Festival. I originally saw it at South by Southwest, I want to say. Honestly, it all blurs at this point. But it's a film called Fast Color, and I'm bringing it up even though it has not been picked up yet, and you cannot see it yet. It is directed by Julia Hart and written by Julia Hart and Jordan Horowitz. You may remember Jordan Horowitz from such things as producing La La Land and being the guy at the Oscars who had to look around him and say, oh, we're up here, but we didn't actually win. The movie stars Gugu Mbatha-Raw, who you may remember from Belle, I believe an old Genevieve Kosky pick for this podcast. And she was in Wrinkle in Time. She was in the San Junipero episode of Black Mirror. She's been in a lot of things with just very interesting roles.
Oh, and she was in Beyond the Lights, one of my favorite movies ever. One of the best romances, of modern romances, I'd say ever.
Which I absolutely should have brought up because that is a terrific film. And I think, like, I'd already seen Belle in theaters, but I think that was the film that kind of for both of us was like, we need to watch everything this woman does.
Exactly.
She stars as a woman who has effectively a superpower that she cannot control. And I don't want to give too much away because you may not be able to see this for a while, but the whole film, it's a small, independent superhero story, effectively. There's a moment in the film where somebody says, we're not superheroes. And then the film kind of unfolds in a way that makes that not entirely true. But people have been talking about this film like it's an origin story for the X-Men's Storm for various reasons. One being that it's about a woman of color with significant powers over basically nature. And another is just there's a tenderness to both her character and to the story that seems like it's something that comes out of Storm's backstory, which we've never really gotten in a meaningful way in X-Men films. The cast in this, it's small, but it's some of my favorite people. David Strathairn is in it. Lorraine Toussaint is in it. And it's a family story. It's a personal, like, evocative little story that happens to be both a superhero story and just kind of a creation story, origin story for an entirely unique little world. I mostly bring this up, given that people can't see it yet, because I think there's going to be news about it pretty soon, and it might be kind of exciting news, at least if people have at least heard of it, if it's on their radar. Otherwise, they're going to be like, oh, yeah, okay, another one of those, sure. Fast Color, I want people to know it's out there, so when they find out what's happening with it next, they'll be as excited as I am about it.
Intriguing.
Keith, what about you?
I've just got kind of a random pick. I was home alone on a Saturday night looking for a horror movie, scanning through Netflix, and I remembered I enjoyed the film. Well, enjoy is not quite right, but I like the film Gerald's Game, and I recognize the director, Mike Flanagan. I'd seen his film Oculus, which I wasn't over the moon for, but I thought it was promising. But I'd heard good things about the films he made in the interim, and this is a Blumhouse production called Hush. that kind of followed the route that a lot of horror movies follow now. It premiered at a film festival and was on Netflix a few weeks later. So it may be a little under the radar, but it's very clever and well executed. And I'm just going to give you the premise. And it's 81 minutes long. You can figure out the rest for yourself when you watch it. But Kate Siegel, who is director Mike Flanagan's wife, who co-wrote the film with him, plays a deaf author living in a sort of somewhat remote house in the country. And she is being menaced by a man who doesn't know that she's deaf. And it's a question of how can she stave off a home invasion, keep alive, you know, kind of use what she can do against him. It's really well done up to a point. I think the end gets a little much at the end, but it's a very satisfying horror film, technically very well done. And Siegel's really good in the lead role. And John Gallagher Jr. As the bad guy is also quite good and quite scary. So I would recommend that. It's getting through Netflix. Remember the movie Hush.
Yeah. Also the name, just remember, it's also the name of the best Buffy the Vampire Slayer episode.
That's true. That's true.
And that's it for this week's edition of The Next Picture Show. Our next episodes come out May 29th and 31st. Genevieve, what are we discussing?
Deadpool 2 arrives in theaters knowing that it's a superhero movie, knowing that it's a sequel, knowing that it's part and apart from the Marvel line, and knowing that you'll appreciate its knowingness. That same irreverent and referential spirit informs Gremlins 2, The New Batch, Joe Dante's anarchic sequel to his 1984 Yuletide hit Gremlins. Given carte blanche from Warner Brothers to do whatever he wanted, Dante decided to make a delirious pop entertainment that combines the slapstick of a Looney Tunes cartoon with a commercial pop of a Frank Tashlin comedy. His first order of business? Torturing the Mogwais that everyone found so adorable in the first one. On the next episodes of The Next Picture Show, we'll look at how Deadpool 2 and Gremlins 2 comment on the studio sequel and use self-reflexivity to their advantage.
In the meantime, we'd love to hear your feedback on this week's discussion of X2, Infinity War, and anything else film-related you'd like to talk about. We want to include your thoughts on future episodes of the show. You can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. We may post your response on Facebook for discussion or read it on a future episode of the show. Finally, before closing out this week's episode, where can we find everyone these days?
You can find my work at the culture section at Vox.com, and you can find me on Twitter at Genevieve Kosky. Scott?
You can find me on Twitter at Scott_Tobias, and you can find my work in the New York Times, Washington Post. I mean, this film worker thing's on Rolling Stone. You know, I'm still recapping The Americans for Vulture, so some stuff is there. So a lot of different little places. So what about you, Keith?
I'm just a young freelancer trying to find my way into the business. By the time this comes out, I might have some clips in such a book publications as The Verge and Vulture, lining up a couple of other things. But yeah, still figuring all this out.
Where can they find you on Twitter?
Oh, on Twitter, you can find me at kfips3000.
And where can they find your work, newly available?
Oh, yeah, I claimed the URL keithfips.com and just collecting my contact information. Clips are on there. If anyone's curious, it should be easy to remember.
Yeah, as the editor dealing with Keith's upcoming Verge piece on what the Marvel Cinematic Universe would look like if they didn't take back the end of Infinity War, I am super, super excited and proud to be featuring his stuff on The Verge. You can find me at, wait, what was it again? Oh yeah, theverge.com, where I'm the film and TV editor. You can find me on Twitter at Tasha Robinson. You can stay updated on The Next Picture Show by visiting nextpictureshow.net, via Twitter at nextpicturepod, and via Facebook at facebook.com/nextpictureshow. And if you haven't subscribed to the show on Apple Podcasts already, please consider it. Apple Podcast subscriptions are an important part of getting podcasts more prominence and more listeners. While you're there, we appreciate every rating and review. Every thumbs up helps us emotionally, and it's like you're teaming up with us in the fight against Thanos. Thanks to Dan the Snake Jakes for his assistance producing this podcast, and thanks to Genevieve Kosky for providing recording space in her home base, Genevieve Kosky's apartment. The Next Picture Show is proud to be part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts and the Panoply Network. Please tune in next time.
So then one day all the heroes were assembled to fight a villain who packed much more than a punch. And his crew was labeled the Avengers. That's the way we all became the Marvel Bunch. The Marvel Bunch. The Marvel Bunch. That's the way.
Hello, brother.
Shut up.